Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Hello. Welcome. Thanks for joining me. I'm Jesse. This is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the campus community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where this show and all of CJSF's programming is produced on the unceded, all of CJSF's local programming is produced on the unceded ancestral territories of the Halkalamilam and Squamish speaking peoples, who have been here since time immemorial, telling stories, sharing music, sharing songs, sharing culture, and otherwise existing. And I'm very grateful to be able to be here and do that in my own way as an uninvited settler. Today, I'm pretty excited about the program. Got some cool things. Local community reporter Danny has a cool piece about a new accessible boat launch and marine recreation program out in Richmond and Steveston. And I will ask you what you know about sea cucumber crime. That's right, sea cucumber crime. I was as intrigued as I can only imagine you are right now. So I spoke to an expert about sea cucumber crime, and I will share my findings with you in a few minutes. But first, we're going to do what we always do and toss a little local music in there. And I am proud to announce that I have found my next obsession when it comes to local music and what I'm going to play a lot of and what you're going to hear a lot of, I think. I think you'll like it, too. It's pretty different from Devours in that it's not electronically based, and it's not super poppy, but it's a little poppy. It's sort of heavy shoegaze, indie rock, etc. From La Lune, who recently put out their new record, Everything is an Eternal Circle, and it repeats and repeats itself. And the record rules. Unsurprisingly, their previous record, Disparity, was a big favorite here at the station. And the new record is more goodness from La Lune. So without further ado, let's listen to Falling 2 by La Lune from Everything is an Eternal Circle, and it repeats and repeats itself on CJSF.
Thank you.
Falling To by La Lune. From Everything Is an Eternal Circle, and it repeats and repeats itself. Here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM. If you like La Lune, you can get their new record now on a split cassette with their previous record Disparity on the other side. And you can also go see them next Friday, the 23rd, not this Friday, but the following one, at Green Auto, along with fellow local rockers Buddy. Do it. It'll be great. And now we will turn to CJSF's community reporter, Danny Nesvedrani.
Reporting from Richmond, BC, this is Danny Nesvedrani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Established in 1988, the Rick Hansen Foundation is a nonprofit organization that was founded by Rick Hansen following the completion of his Man in Motion world tour that helped raise $26 million towards spinal cord injury research. For over 35 years, the organization has worked to raise awareness, change attitudes, and remove barriers for people with disabilities. On May 8th, the Rick Hansen Foundation held an event at the Gulf of Georgia Cannery National Historic Site in Richmond, BC, celebrating the launch of the organization's newest venture, their Accessible Outdoors program. The newly launched program aims to make outdoor activities more accessible for people living with disabilities by inspiring new projects, initiatives, and policies that enable access and inclusion. Their first goal? To make the ocean a place that is accessible for all. During the event, Rick Hansen unveiled the Everyone Everywhere, a boat that takes into consideration the safety and comfort needs of people living with disabilities. The Rick Hansen Foundation identified boating as something that is often inaccessible for people living with disabilities due to a lack of design consideration for these populations. CJSF was able to take a tour of the vessel, where Hansen spoke at length of the new opportunities that it provides for people living with disabilities.
Yeah, the reason we wanted to start in the marine environment was because, first of all, that's one of the biggest barriers out there. Is if almost every marina that exists, every boat that's being built, is actually not accessible. And so when you have a marina, a host marina like the Steveston Harbor Authority, that's actually thinking about accessibility, it's a shining example of what could be everywhere. The boats that are being built are built in general without accessibility in mind, and they're hard to adapt. Even if they, they're purchased by someone, and someone has a stroke or an injury, they really feel like they actually have to get rid of the boat and maybe not even be able to participate again. And by the way, accessibility is one of the fastest segments of the global tourism industry. And so when we bring people here to British Columbia and they go out whale watching, they go out, sport fishing, they do ecotourism, we want them to be able to participate. And it should be good for Canada to be able to actually offer this and really attract more people to be here.
Hansen then went on to give a more detailed explanation of the possibilities that this boat provides.
In this boat, we want to be able to have the back section, which is typically, it's the working section. It's where you can actually go out and be a researcher and work on conservation. You can clean up, ghost nets in the river that don't need to be there and put it into recycling. Or you can work on habitat or do sonar assessment or tag fish and monitor them and release them. Or you can be a recreational fisherman or fisherwoman. And so these are the opportunities in the back, where you can be outdoors doing a cruise and doing, an ecotourism, example where a First Nations leader can be a host and they can actually have a disability and actually be on the water for the first time in their entire life, talking about their heritage and how important the river is to their nation and to all of us, and how we have to make sure that it's healthy so that it's sustainable for the future.
We then had the opportunity to go onto the vessel, where Hansen spoke on how the adaptable design of this boat can hopefully inspire other manufacturers to take note of these design choices.
You make it general for everybody, and then you can, if you put anything unique that's kind of fixed, you can actually, once you have the floor plan, you can easily adapt it. You can move it around or take it if somebody has different needs or Like, for instance, if I purchased this and I was able-bodied, if I put, like, fixed seats in, then, you know, the boat has been built so that if someone came along and they were in a wheelchair, they could take the seats out, put the lift in, and it would be a simple adaptation because there's no structural barrier in the way. But if it was structurally changed, you know, where that open floor plan didn't exist, then it would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars and it would be prohibitive to make the change.
Hansen then provided some remarks on the time it's taken for himself, as well as the foundation, to reach this point.
We've come a long way in 40 years of everybody working towards making change, and there's a lot to celebrate, and I'm incredibly grateful for the many champions and people who have actually taken up that challenge and implemented solutions. But it's also a reality check of, you know, the fact that we've got a long way to go. So this is an example of yet another barrier being removed. So let's just keep going. We're not over.
For those wanting to learn more about the Rick Hansen Foundation's Accessible Outdoors program, as well as how to book an appointment on the Everyone Everywhere vessel, you can go to rickhansen.com. Once again, this has been Danny Nazvatarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
Volunteering at CJSF 90.1 FM is a great experience and is easy to get started, so I'll tell you a little bit about it in the hope that you reach out. As this station is run almost entirely by volunteers, you have a variety of ways to get active at CJSF. Every department can use a little bit of help. Arts and entertainment. Well, you can write and produce reviews, conduct interviews of local musicians, the music library, acquiring, organizing, reviewing, and compiling charts. Public affairs. Interviewing groups, attending events, recording lectures. Public relations. Postering, graphic design, and programming. You can host your own show or work on a collective. Production, audio editing, and PSA building. And once you feel comfortable, you can even volunteer to help the volunteers. So volunteer with us at CJSF 90.1. Email us at vol4cjsf@sfu.ca.
Si tu m'aimes, si tu m'aimes, si tu m'aimes, tout toi me
Welcome back to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. That was Lila Gray and Michael Isaac. Tamil Nam, you're my man, from the deluxe edition of Scared of the Dark, You Should Be Too. That's just one of the regular tracks, but it is from the deluxe edition. Thanks for joining me today on Speak Up. We've reached the moment you're all waiting for. I know my tease earlier in the episode really got you going about sea cucumber crime, so we're going to go to my interview with Dr. Teal Phelps Bondarov, who, well, he'll introduce himself in a moment. I do want to just flag that in this conversation, which we recorded on May 1st, about 2 weeks ago at this point, we were waiting on results from a sentencing for a court case that was supposed to occur on May 1st or 2nd. But it appears that has been pushed back until July. So we talk about that a little bit. Just know that while we thought the results were going to be apparent by the time this airs, it looks like it won't. So, yeah. Anyway, without further ado, this is my conversation with Teal Phelps Bondarov.
For the purposes of today's conversation, I'm the Director of Research for Oceans Asia. We're a marine conservation group, but I also wear a ton of other hats. I'm the chair and co-founder of Access BC, the campaign that fought for free contraception in BC. Wow. And I'm also a counselor in the District of Saanich and do research on Canadian and international politics.
I guess the best place to start is, what is a sea cucumber?
Yeah, so sea cucumbers are echinoderms. They're marine invertebrates that are closely related to starfish. And they have what's called pentaradial symmetry. So they're sort of the same on five sides. So if you look at animals in this broader family, you've got starfish and brittle stars and sea urchins and sea cucumbers. What's really interesting about the work that I do is a lot of it is just simply teaching people that sea cucumbers are not vegetables and are in fact really important species in marine environments. But they've been described as the earthworms of the sea. And the two big species that people will see out here on the West Coast are the giant sea cucumber and the orange sea cucumber. They go by a lot of names, but if folks are going down to the high tide line on this beautiful upcoming weekend, look for a splash of orange. And if you see a splash of orange, it's most likely an orange sea cucumber. And if you go a little bit deeper down, you might see a big, large red sea cucumber with little spikes on it. And those are going to be your giant sea cucumber or your California sea cucumber, depending on your political philosophy towards naming. But what's really interesting is there's around 30 species in BC waters. I've only ever seen those two, and I've been studying these things for a while. And there's about 1,700 species that have been described around the world. Yeah, they're basically the earthworms of the sea, and they come in all shapes and sizes.
So you've described them just now and before as the earthworms of the sea, and you said that they're important to marine ecosystems. Can you specify like why they are important and what that action is?
Yeah, so they're deposit and suspension feeders. So they feed on waste. And the two species out here in the West Coast are a really good way of sort of illustrating the two different feeding strategies that sea cucumbers have. The giant sea cucumbers are deposit feeders. So they will burrow their way through the seafloor, eating the bits of other things that have collected there. And then the orange sea cucumbers are suspension feeders. Some people may have seen a couple of viral videos of these beautiful feeding apparatus that they use, and they kind of use their arms to draw in food into their mouths. And they kind of look like a sea anemone in that way. And in this way, they engage in bioturbation. So they're turning up the sediment and they're processing sediment. They're doing nutrient cycling. And so they're very much acting like earthworms in the oceans. And one of my favorite expressions is that every grain of sand in the ocean has at one time passed through a sea cucumber. And that's because they eat a lot and they defecate a lot. There was a study out of Heron Island in Queensland, Australia, a couple of years ago, where they were looking at a 19 square kilometer reef. And they figured out, and they did the math, and they being some fantastic researchers, they figured out that the average sea cucumber defecates around 30 grams a day. And the amount of sea cucumber poop in this one small reef was the equivalent of 5 Eiffel Towers a year.
Wow.
So they're really important to the marine ecosystems in that respect. And they excrete nitrogen and phosphorus and ammonia. And they also have some really interesting other ecosystem services they provide. One of the ones that a lot of the young listeners might appreciate, and actually I think all listeners might appreciate, is sort of the commensal relationship that some sea cucumbers have in the deep ocean. And there's a fish called the pearlfish. And there's not a lot of places for it to hide in the deep ocean. And so it has created a habitat inside the anal cavity of a sea cucumber species. And it's this interesting relationship between the two animals. And some sea cucumbers don't mind. Some of them have evolved what they call anal teeth to sort of fend off fish. It's this very interesting relationship. But yeah, when we're talking about sea cucumbers, there's a lot of fun poop jokes that some of the young folks find kind of entertaining.
Of course. And you're joining me today. You talked about yourself as an expert in sea cucumber crime. What is sea cucumber crime in your parlance? How would you describe it?
This is a very niche job, right? So there's only about, I think, 8 to 10 people who study crime in sea cucumber fisheries around the world. I'm one of them. My co-author on many papers, Felix Moreau, is another one. I think collectively, when we get together, it counts as almost a quorum of experts in the field. But basically, what sea cucumber crime is it's crime in sea cucumber fisheries. And the reason why we use the term as broadly as possible is it's not just illegally fishing for sea cucumbers. What my work in illegal fishing more broadly has found is that we actually see crime at every stage of the fishery supply chain, whether that's people forging permits or fishing out of season, fishing with illegal gear, fishing over their limits, fishing with forced labor on their boats, to laundering products through legal markets, to lying about where the products came from, to smuggling across borders, to lying on customs forms, to extortion, to bribery, and all other forms of crime. And so when you look at fisheries in general, you can see all this crime. And when we look at sea cucumber fisheries, we see a significant amount of crime around the world. And what's really fascinating and what drew me into this area was Oceans Asia, my marine conservation organization, we've been looking at wildlife crime for a while, marine wildlife crime. And I've been looking at illegal fishing for, gosh, many years now. And what was interesting was one of our focuses, my colleague Gary Stokes, has been studying and working on investigating crime in shark fin fisheries for many years. If anyone's seen the documentary Seaspiracy on Netflix, that's Gary doing his work on shark fins. Eli Roth's documentary Fin takes a deep dive into shark finning. We did a lot of work on that. And the conversation that we had was, okay, so what happens if we win? And progress is being made. Younger generations in Southeast Asia are less interested in eating shark fins. This is a luxury seafood item. The Chinese Communist Party banned it from banquets because it's so expensive. It's seen as a form of bribery. So what happens next? And basically the conversation was, well, the demand for luxury seafood products isn't going to go away. It's likely to shift to other species. What would those be? And we figured that it would likely be the other treasures of Cantonese cuisine. So you've got shark fin, abalone, fish maw, and sea cucumber. Fish maw, for listeners who have never heard that expression, is the swim bladder of the fish. It's the part of the fish that allows it to go up and down in the water column. And these are also a luxury seafood product. And when we looked at the markets for those products, a ton of research had already been done into abalone. There's a really strong connection between abalone trade in South Africa and organized crime syndicates selling methamphetamines and firearms. So we didn't need to do a lot of work there. So the two that we wanted to look at were fish maw and sea cucumbers. And no one was talking about sea cucumbers and crime in those fisheries. So basically, at the beginning of the pandemic, I set up and took a deep dive into the literature, and we've been looking at it ever since.
What have you learned?
Well, we started off by doing a global survey to try to find hotspots. Basically, figure out, look, we know there's crime in the fishery because it's a high-value marine commodity. So where is that crime likely to be? And the biggest hotspot was India and Sri Lanka. So my first paper that came out, oh, I think it was several years ago, looked at crime in Indian and Sri Lankan sea cucumber fisheries. And what was really interesting there is in India, sea cucumber fishing is illegal. In Sri Lanka, it's regulated. And so what you see is people are poaching sea cucumbers in India, bringing them into Sri Lanka illegally, and then laundering them through the legal fish markets there. And then they eventually make their way to Southeast Asia. And that study was really kind of eye-opening for me, the sheer scale of it. Like, we found over the course of only a few years, 120 incidents, 502 arrests, and you're averaging 4 people per arrest. And what was fascinating about that case was you could actually track the crime as it moved from region to region. This is a trend called the roving bandits, where basically you have buyers that show up in a town and they're like, hey, We're buying sea cucumbers and we're buying them for $2 a sea cucumber. And that's a very attractive deal, especially for folks who are maybe in lower income and developing country situations. And so they start fishing for sea cucumbers. Well, the sea cucumbers that are there are right on the foreshore. You can pick them up and bring them home, but those quickly disappear. We are talking about the earthworms of the sea. They don't move fast. We're not talking about, you know, fishers chasing after them at high speeds. They're worms. They just chill. So basically, those ones are extirpated quite quickly. And then you end up using divers with the hookah diving method to dive deeper for sea cucumbers. And those are eventually wiped out. And the challenge with sea cucumbers is they're broadcast breeders. And what that means is they need a certain density of animals in one area in order to effectively reproduce. And when that number drops below a certain density, they just don't recover, or they take decades to recover. And so basically, those populations are wiped out. Well, the people who live in that town can't really up and move. But the buyers move on to the next town and they do what's called, you know, serial exploitation, where they move from town to town, exploiting the population as these roving bandits. And in our work in India and Sri Lanka, we found you could actually just track that, where there was some exploitation in the northern part of Sri Lanka because of low governance following the civil war. And then the crime moved over to Lakshadweep and the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. Basically, you can track it as law enforcement kind of chases it around. The next area we looked at was Mexico. And this was brought to my attention, again, through looking at news stories. And we weren't able to go into the field because of the pandemic and also safety and budgetary constraints. So we've been looking at mostly news media reports and government reports. And in Mexico, looking at from 2011 to 2021, so 10 years, there was 96 cases, 125 arrests, over 100 tons of sea cucumbers at a value of around $29 million U.S. were being, you know, poached from the ocean. But what was really eye-opening for Mexico was you also have the involvement of cartels and people being murdered and theft and robbery of sea cucumbers. And it was very intense to study some of the cases there. And what got us onto Canadian sea cucumber crime, the paper that I just had come out last week, was journalists kept asking me, well, okay, so there's, you know, lots of cases in India and you've got violence in Mexico. What's going on in Canada?